So, I mean, we look at something which is, you know, deceptively simple. But if we want to test the limits of whether it's truly a quantum system, or where we can learn something about a quantum system, or if we're engineers, whether we can use it to engineer some process that's going to achieve the efficiencies that we demand of quantum devices, then all of those things require us to look this deeply in order to understand that. So that's what we want to do today. Now, we had so far some pretty simple pictures of this. We say that ideally what should happen is that based upon this phase flash, we should rotate the neutrons between these two outcomes. And of course, they'll be in a coherent superposition coming out of this third blade after the quantum interference effect. So we've got, you know, the two nice pieces here that says we have superposition, and here we have interference. And we see those things coming out. We saw in the first lecture experimentally that the contrast, which is a level of the interference effect here, wasn't perfect. So we're still exploring that piece. And remember that we described this as a rotation about the y-axis. So we would say, oh, ideally that's a 90-degree rotation about the y-axis. And this is a rotation of some phase about the z-axis. This is a mirror, which I'm just going to neglect for now. And this is a rotation also about the y-axis. Now, if I include the mirror, I could say, oh, well, then this becomes effectively a rotation about the negative axis. And you'd be really happy with that, I think, because then you would say, ah, I recognize this, you know. I don't know what book you use for classical mechanics, but, you know, go back to the appendix of Goldstein or whatever you use. And you'd say, ah, well, this thing is a rotation about the x-axis. And you would say, oh yeah, the system comes in over here, right? It comes in on this well-defined state, but it's well-defined, of course, along the z-axis, right? I mean, so here's the element I have to vary. You know, that's my control element. In this system, we have one control element, pretty boring. You say, well, I've got this control element, but of course, the control element commutes with the input state, so nothing interesting would happen. So we rotate it to a non-commuting basis, and now we can get something interesting happening out of it. Right? And so that's the simple picture of the interferometer. And I asked you, I don't know whether it was a homework or a tutorial, I never get all these things right, but to say, hey, how would you modify this to rotate anywhere on the block sphere? You know, clearly, if we just have one rotation, I should have put that bracket there. If we just have one rotation, and it's about the x-axis, and we start off along z, we can't get everywhere in the block sphere, right? We can just rotate in the z-y plane with this process. And did you find a modification that takes you everywhere in the block sphere? No. Okay. Anyone have a quick suggestion? All right, let me give you one that I think is cheating. One quick one is to say, I'll change the width of that blade, right? And so they change this angle. And then if I change that angle, right, I could go anywhere on the block sphere, because instead of always going from z to, you know, to the x-axis, I could go anywhere in between. You know, I consider it cheating because mechanically I don't have a way of taking that crystal and making it fatter or thinner. At least I don't have a way of doing it, back and forth. Yeah? But now look at this piece. Here we said, oh, we've got this rotation. This is our control element. So I'd really like to add another one of these. But of course, I can't add it here because it would commute. So there'd be nothing interesting. And I can't add it here because it would still commute. There'd be nothing interesting, right? Okay. So now I'd like you to think about it for 2 minutes. It's enough of a hint. You have to modify the interferometer. How do you modify the interferometer to go everywhere along the Bloch sphere? Over the Bloch sphere. Yeah, thanks. So he says, hey, that's cool. We'll put another phase flag here. Now, if I put a phase flag there, and I just left my detectors along Z here, then we end up with one more problem, right, that we would never be able to tell. Because now the operation of the phase flag, so let's call it phi prime of Z, in our detectors, which are along Z, would commute. And so I need to do one more thing. Say this again. Perfect. So we put another mirror here. We put another blade. And now we detect. Right? And now, based upon these two controls, we can go anywhere over the Bloch sphere. Good. All right. So it's worthwhile analyzing that. I'm going to take it off the board so it doesn't confuse us later. But good. You understand. And we've got these measurements, O and H. Good. Okay. Now, we saw that the first type of error or imperfection that comes in is that when we build the crystal, it's not perfectly pi over 2. And we included that in an operator, right? We defined the operator for that. Like so. Okay? So we can calculate it. Now, of course, this error here, or this imperfection, doesn't change whether the system is unitary or not, right? So given that piece, the system will still be, it'll still be unitary. It's just not going to do what we want it to do. Yeah? So and of course, you know, the very fact that we wrote it as a unitary operator tells us directly. And then we saw last class that if we put a magnetic field over a part of the interferometer, over only one leg of the interferometer, we would introduce an incoherence. We'd introduce a noise in the system that we would model by summing over processes, right? We said we were going to sum over the spin up and the spin down state. And when the two dynamics for that were different, then we found that we moved inside the Bloch sphere. Now I'm going to intentionally put in an element that's going to introduce a phase shift. And this prism that I've introduced here, I actually want it to come out to the board. So let me put in our coordinate system again. So we have X, Y, and Z coming out to the board. And the way this prism is going to work is it will be along the Z axis. And again, we're going to make it out of silica. So it's going to be just introduce a phase shift that's proportional to the width along the z-axis. And I remind you that the beam that comes into the interferometer has a width along the z-axis, anywhere from 8 to about 1.5 centimeters, from 8 millimeters to 1.5 centimeters, depending upon the precision of what we want to be doing. So we have this wide range of neutrons. And normally we'd like to think that each of these neutrons we're going to treat exactly the same way. But now by putting this prism in here, I'm going to introduce a phase shift that's dependent upon their actual location along the z-direction. And you might think, oh, why do you do this? One reason we do it is we'd like to have a few neutrons at our detector. And already you saw that there are very few neutrons that hit the detector. If I shrunk the beam down till this was really small, then I would lose all those neutrons, and so it would cost a signal. The other reason is, you could see that I put the prism here, is I want to learn something about that degree of freedom. Okay? So, I want to describe this in terms of a wave number. And the wave number is going to be, of course, 2 pi over the periodicity of the sample. And so I can think about this as saying, yes, as I move down here, I'll get a larger and larger phase. Okay. And I know that every time I change this width by 40 microns of adding pi phase shift to it. And so the operator that we'll see is still an operator along the z-direction, just like this phase shift. But the extent of the phase is the wave number times the actual location in there. Okay? Good. And let me digress for just a moment because I keep going back from sigma z to projectors. And it's useful to define 2 eigenpotents. That are typically labeled E plus and minus. And you can see that E plus is this, E minus is that. They have some really nice properties. Of course, they're projectors, so they square to themselves. And again, they're projectors and they're orthogonal, so their product is 0. And so sigma z is E plus minus E minus, and the identity operator is E plus plus E minus, right? And the reason I do that is it says, oh, I'm going to be a little bit nicer to myself. And here, I'm going to put E plus there. And so now it says, oh, yes, only in the top path will I have a rotation. So I'll put the prism in just one path. And as an exercise, take that and look at the power series of it. You'll see, go ahead and expand it out. You'll see some very nice properties that these things have if you haven't looked at that before. Okay, good. Okay, so now that we've got this prism in there, and of course, it's bloody easy to calculate what happens in this system. Now, the incoming beam, we assume, has no z dependence. If you're going to look at the effect of an incoherent process, it's very important to make sure that, that the incoherence you're seeing is in the device and not a remnant of something that came before the device. And so we demand this piece. Or in other words, as you're building the equipment, that's something you have to engineer in, that's an obligation you have to make sure that that works right. And then we can just go ahead and calculate. We can say that, yeah, what we'll see is that we have some input state, and now I can tell you that of course is E plus, right? We just defined that. So that's good. And then we've got the unitary of the first blade. And then we have the unitary of the phase flag. And then we have the mirror. And then we have this prism. And now I want to describe the prism as being a function of Q, right? And so we've defined it right here. It's worth taking one moment. Over here, I said, we can change this phase flag because I can rotate it. And I said, no, we can't change those blades because I don't know how to. And now here I'm suggesting that, in fact, we can change this angle, right? As I change that angle, then I change Q. It may not be obvious that you can do that. But if you take two prisms, and there, it's nice if you take two circular prisms, but, you know, just take two prisms, period. Put them back to back and make them identical. Then if I rotate them in opposite directions, then along the center line, I have a varying prism. I can change that angle, right? And so we can go from having something that looks like that to something that looks like that, and I can do it continuously. So in fact, this with a variable Q is not easy, but it's quite doable. And then we have the third blade. And then we need to remember that this thing is integrated over Z, so we need to integrate this with the probability of Z dz. And the only place that Z is going to enter into this piece initially is through those terms, right? And so now then we have some density matrix that comes out, which is a function of Q. Of course, it's not a function of Z. We've integrated over that piece. Yeah? All right, so now then we have something that we perfectly expect is going to lose purity as we vary Q, right? And of course, Q equals zero corresponds to there's no prism, it just looks flat. Yep. The last thing to say is that this probability, of course, now is the probability that there is a neutron at that position in Z. Yeah? All right. So now we go ahead and do this. So we define all this stuff, you can look at it. You'll forgive me for putting the prism before the mirror in this notes. I should have made a correspondence, but it makes no difference, right? We go ahead, calculate it. There's some nice math. Who cares? Math is always easy. It's the physics that's important. Okay, so here I plot the O-beam intensity versus phase. So that phase is this phase, right? If I don't vary the phase and I would just get the number out, you know, I say, ah, I have an 80% chance that a neutron hits the O detector and 20% it hits the H detector. It doesn't tell me anything. In order to know what's going on in this system, I need to vary the phase and record a contrast curve. And as I vary the phase, well, if Q is equal to zero, of course, we see the contrast curve we saw before. So we see a nice sinusoidal curve that is, in fact, 1 plus cosine divided by 2. And we see that as we go and increase Q, we lose the contrast. And this, of course, is different than what happens when we had the magnetic terms. Remember, the magnetic pieces, we lost contrast. But because there was only two elements of the distribution, then what we would see is an oscillation of the contrast, right? Here, in fact, at some point, we lose contrast entirely. And it decreases, in fact, as 1 over Q. And, of course, the O beam intensity looks the same, right? It just averaged over those two, right? There's, you know, one's plus cosines, one's minus cosines. So there's no big deal there. Now, there's two pieces to remember here. One, we haven't actually lost any contrast, right? We're still summing over unitary dynamics. And the reason that the contrast appears to vanish is that when I look with my detector here, the detector records the presence of the neutron independently of its location in Z, right? So it's the way I make the measurement that causes me to lose that contrast. And one of the things we can do, we'll do it over here again, is to take the helium-3 detector and replace it with an imaging detector. So we put a thin layer of boron fluoride. So we have boron. Boron is a great scintillator. Boron 10 will capture a neutron, and it'll give off a photon. And then if I have a photon, then I can put a CCD here. And I can take a picture of those photons, just like we would do it with your camera and your cell phone. Two challenges. One, that of course the layer of boron better be thin, right? If I make a thick layer of boron, then I get a blurry image, right? Because if I, you know, let's look at that just for a second. Let's say I had a thick layer of boron, and then I have my CCD, and I say, ah, where does light come for that particular pixel? Well, then it comes from everything that can reach it in the solid angle of that pixel, right? So it comes from all of this area here. And so I get a blurred picture. Whereas if I make it really thin, it can only come from those little spots there. Okay? So we say, oh yeah, I want for high resolution, I want this to be thin. Of course, if it's thin, the probability of capturing a neutron is small, right? So there's always a trade-off that I can have high sensitivity and low resolution, or can make it thin, have high resolution and low sensitivity. All right. But we can, in fact, use them. And so here are pictures of the detected neutrons, putting one of these imaging plates here. And what we're mapping is, of course, the z-axis in this direction. And here you see the width of the beam. And if I put this at one of these detectors, right, well, we know the intensity. The intensity in this detector as we go through all this math Well, the intensity better be that it looks like 1 plus cosine of qz plus phi divided by 2. Right? We're looking as a function of z, so I no longer integrate over z. Right? And now I have an intensity that varies with z. Yeah? And as I change q to larger and larger pieces, we get a higher and higher periodicity. Yeah. Okay. And there's some movies there that show you that. But I don't have to go through every little piece of this with you. Now, if I put another detector in the H beam, so I have this imaging plate. And if I put a plate here, what would I see on those two plates? Perfect. So it'll be similar. Except it has to fill in, right? So the neutron has to hit one of the detectors. So it either hits this one or that one. And so somewhere here, we show you that we have the two detectors, and they truly are complementary to each other, just as we expect. Yeah? Okay. Now, the reason we went to this trouble is neutron studies are one of the best ways of looking at materials, and they are great ways of looking at hydrogen, because of course neutrons are light, and so they scatter off hydrogen, whereas of course in X-rays that's a drag. Also, neutrons have no charge. So they penetrate. So if we're looking at hydrogen embrittlement in aluminum, say, so you want to take the rotor of a jet engine and see hydrogen embrittlement for the fins in a rotor on a jet plane falling apart with time, which they do, then you can map that out. It's very hard to do that with any other technique, because either you're going to have a probe that doesn't interact with hydrogen but goes through the aluminum, or you'll have a probe that doesn't go through but would have interacted. And so neutrons are unique in that sense. They're wonderful for magnetism. So if we're looking at spintronic devices or looking at magnetic heads, we can look at imaging with neutrons, and they're great. For looking at protein structures and fluids, we use them also to look at fuel cells, looking at water inside batteries and how it moves around in a fuel cell. But if I do it like this, we have no sensitivity to talk about. I mean, these things, you know, it's nice to do once to show you that this stuff works. But that's an abysmal experiment. And neutron experiments already take long, right? So you don't want to make something that takes long even longer. But we have this periodicity, right? That's a very nice structure. So I can take my sample, I can put it here. And we'll say that there's some density of material as a function of z. And now, this prism is going to pick out a periodic structure from this material. And so we'll get a contrast that goes roughly as the contrast. So let's say C of Q goes as the integral of A of z e to the I qz dz. And now we're really happy, right? Because if we measure this signal as a function of Q, and we take the Fourier transform of this, then we directly return this function, right? And so now we can use the coherence that we have in neutron interferometry to do a more efficient measurement. And you can see also that we sample the whole sample at once, we sample it coherently at once, and all we need to do is just change that width of that prism. So that's a new application. As you're looking at quantum physics, you'll be amazed at where you can find applications. And we entered into this field to look at foundational questions in quantum mechanics, and then you find that you're building devices for the aircraft industry or for the fuel cell industry. Okay, now I wanted to change and do two more things here, because the prism's nice. It shows us the way that this incoherence comes out of the process, okay? But it doesn't yet get us to what was going on in that first neutron interferometry experiment, right? We saw a loss of contrast, and we certainly didn't accidentally put a prism in there, okay? So we wanted to look at that. But before I go and do that, I need to ask a question. What happens if I put two prisms in there? I have Q and Q prime. What do I see? And when the two are equal? I'm sorry, I didn't hear you. Right, so when the two prisms have the same Q value, then it's just like they weren't there at all, right? So that they effectively cancel out.
And they can also help each other.
Yeah, absolutely right. So if we look here, so this is, again, you can look in the notes. This is a calculation of the O-beam intensity versus the contrast curve, so that's the phase. Here, I'm varying the Q of one prism, and I've set the other prism to 10. So I've set it to this point. You can see exactly as you expected that when I set the second prism to 10 as well, then I get the contrast back. When I make the second prism bigger or smaller, the contrast goes away. And as with everything in physics, experimentally it works. Right. The experiments always work. Your model of them may not, but nature's good like that. So here is what I've done. So we've looked at two different prisms. If I look at these points, we're just looking at the contrast curve versus the Q on this. And we see that at zero, we get this nice one, and we get, the reason we get this little hump here is, of course, the beam is finite in width. So when we integrate over it, we get a sinc function. So I get a sine Q over Q. So the contrast really does fall off as Q, as I said, but we get a few bumps because of the sine Q piece. Yeah. And then when I set the two equal, we get an echo. So we put all of the incoherence away, remove that. Good. Now then, let's do something more interesting. Oh, it's worthwhile also asking the question. I put those two prisms in there, and it doesn't matter if I line them up right. Right? So I have a, let's draw that. Make sure you see all the physics. I've got the beam coming in. And then I can put one prism here. And of course, then I have the other leg of the interferometer, and the beam comes in. And the other leg. I put another prism. I put it like that. So as long as they have the same angle, this separation here doesn't matter, right? Because it's going to show up as a global phase. So the experiment's easier to do. Okay. Now then, let's go and look at the system that we really have. We don't, in fact, have something so nice as a prism in there. What we have is roughness on these blades. It says that the surface of the blades is not perfectly smooth. It's really good. We try really hard. But it's not perfectly smooth. And so this imperfection leads to a phase just like this, about the z-axis. Okay, so now then we say, oh yeah, I have some noise. And remember, let's just walk through it. If I have imperfections on this side of that blade, well, they don't matter because they commute with the incoming beam, right? So we just throw those away. You'll never see that. If I have errors on the outside of the last blade, well, they commute with the measurement operators. So we just throw those away. We'll never see those either. If I have errors here or on either side of this blade or on this side of this thing, well, everything there is a Z operator. So it commutes, and so we just add them all up. We get one number. And if I have errors on either side of these, well, there's nothing in between, so we just add those up. And then you say, well, why? What happens here? Well, what happens here is this blade is ideally a pi rotation, right? That blade was ideally a pi rotation about the x-axis. So it just takes z to z, right? So, hey. It says, oh, you should add them up over here and subtract them over there. But you shouldn't do that because they're random events, right? It's noise. So noise always gets worse. You can't add up two noise sources and get better. Always worse. Okay, so we simply have one overall Z noise that's going to distort the system. And so then we say, oh, okay, I've got some noise here. I've got some noise here. And I'm going to make a change. I'm going to say, oh, this is Z. This goes back to our dummy variable now. No longer means location in space, right? Just says, it's a dummy variable again. This thing says, what's the probability of having a rotation? I need to have some shape for this. If I want to have a shape for noise, then we say, well, tell us something we can integrate. And you know, theoretical physicists, the only thing you guys can integrate is Gaussians. Maybe that's an overstatement. But we always drop in and say, oh, no, it's a Gaussian, right? So we have a term that looks like e to the minus z squared over 2 sigma squared, square root of 2 pi sigma, right? So this is going to be the probability that we have a certain noise, right? And the noise itself, I'll put that back to Z, put noise there. it's just going to be a rotation, right? But now it's a random rotation over that. And now we're going to integrate over this function. So we do that. We define some Gaussian. And now as I change the strength, as I change the width of that Gaussian distribution, so I'm changing sigma. Remember that sigma is the width of a Gaussian distribution. I'm assuming you've seen this over and over and over again. Okay, so as we change it, then we see that we get a loss of contrast. And of course, as the face becomes large, as the noise becomes large, we completely lose the contrast, right? We were equally likely to be in either of the two beams. We're equally likely to come out at either of the two detectors, right? Whatever leg of the interferometer we're in, you stay in. And now that I can take and I can combine those two pieces, right? Now we have a complete description of the process. And I can combine the transmission coefficient and the noise. So remember the transmission coefficient. Yeah, the transmission coefficient is just cosine of theta. Get a question.
So we're no longer thinking of Z as it's just a dummy variable, but we're still putting a Gaussian distribution on this.
Yeah. Okay, so thanks for the question. We're saying that we have some random phases there. And if I look over this beam, then I will see some random events. And it'll have nothing to do with where we are in the beam, right? They'll be random. But if I integrated over this and I said, what's the probability that I get some phase, right? So I plot phase versus the probability. Or let's just call that axis delta, the width of it, right? And if I say, what's the probability that I have some noise, then okay. If we look over enough, we'll see that it will eventually look like a Gaussian. Yeah. And of course, the phase is directly proportional to that. Yes, please.
I guess this error is in the rotation around y-axis. Why do you consider it to be error of the rotation around z-axis?
Thanks. That's a really good question. So the question is, I've got this blade, and this blade is giving me a diffraction event, which looks like a rotation about the y-axis. In other words, it's taking a well-defined beam coming in and it's splitting them to those two. And then I say, oh, let me add some gibbish here. And as I do that, I'm going to model it about z. You say, well, what went on? The y piece is what happens for the Bragg scattering term of the blade. Okay, so if you remember for Bragg scattering, we had the beam come in and it coherently interacts with this blade to go in those two directions because we're in the Lowy geometry. What I'm modeling as a noise is to say that there's some stray bits and pieces of silicon still on the surface. And they're not big enough to cause a change in the diffraction condition. But the exiting neutrons still have to go through it. So they introduce a phase. Okay, so it's just a media event, but it's a great question. So thanks. Okay, so now if we look at the transmission coefficient, of course what we want to see is the transmission coefficient should look like the square root of 2. And there we go. And we get a nice contrast curve. right? And we'd like noise to be zero, but we can add it in. And what we find, of course, is here. There's our best data again. And you'll show me that, in fact, there's only one solution that fits those two. See if I can find something that's about right. You'll notice in the experimental data that we don't quite get to zero. Okay, so I don't quite get to one, though I don't know what one is actually. But I do know what zero is. And so we can adjust those. And we saw that that the two beams approximately met. So we need to change that a little bit. Come on. Earlier today, I had no problem doing this. Something like that. So we can see that that there ends up that in this particular interferometer, we're pretty far away from the ideal transmission coefficient, which is why these things don't come down. And of course, we have a reasonable amount of noise in the system. Yeah. Okay. Now, this is the entire model. We don't need in this system to go further than this. But I do want to say how we should think about it. So let's just take these two pieces together. So the first one says that we have some variation in the transmission coefficient, right? And so we know that the ideal case is that effectively we have a sigma x operator. So ideal is that u corresponds to a theta rotation about x is equal to that. Now, we have some part of it that says, oh, no. So for some neutrons, they don't see that rotation, right? The transmission coefficient is wrong. Yeah, they don't have a 50-50 split at the first blade. You can say, oh, yeah. For some neutrons, effectively, we just have the identity operator going through. That for some of the neutrons, there's no rotation. So you could say, imagine that I've changed this rotation axis. It's easiest to see it, perhaps, in the Bloch sphere picture. Remember our Bloch sphere picture. It says, the good stuff is that we rotate down, we rotate around by some amount, and then we rotate back up over here, and we end up with a vector there. The reality is that we rotate not quite all the way down. We still have a good rotation about the z-axis. And then we rotate not quite all the way back to the z-axis. And effectively what it looks like is that for some neutrons, we never did anything. So what you're going to show me is that if you take the Krauss picture, right, Now you have everything you need from this. And so you can calculate for me the superoperator. And you can calculate the superoperator as a function of the transmission coefficient and of sigma. And then given that, you can go ahead and look at what happens when you take that to the Krauss maps. Now, of course, if I take the transmission coefficient to be perfect, and if I take sigma to be zero, we're going to get this. If I take the transmission coefficient to be something other, or if I take this angle, this equivalent, to be something other than pi over 2, right, then I'm going to end up with some of this. And so now then here we say, our Krauss map is simply with probability equal to 1, we have, you know, m sub 1 is equal to e to the I phi sigma x over 2, right? Boring map. Yeah? Here, we say, no. With some probability, 1 minus p the square root of 2, we have the correct thing going on, right? So that's M1. And then M2 says that with probability p, we actually get the identity. Now, when you were in Dan's class, all of his Krauss maps always had the identity up here because he was probably always looking at this as an error from the identity, right? But I can do anything I want with unitaries. So I'm looking at an error from this rotation. Yep. All right. So there's that piece. And then you say, hey, what if I added, so this is sigma equals 0. And then you say, well, and you can tell me, you can relate that, of course, to that rotation vector. Then you say, if I take sigma not equal to 0, right? Well, sigma not equal to 0 says I have a phase rotation here, right? But this phase rotation looks like a x rotation, right? But of course, now it's a random rotation. So when this is equal to that, we say, with probability 1, forget that probability 1 stuff. The first piece says 1 minus p, we have the right thing going on. And the second piece says that, hey, in addition to the right thing going on, I have a sigma x operator here. I get that other piece that I have to put in there. Yeah, you had a question? No, okay. And then you're gonna add these two up, okay? Now, of course, when you add them up, you need to be careful that you don't add up the square roots of probabilities, right? These are classical probabilities. You better get those right, right? So you add up probabilities and take the square root afterwards. But then you can go ahead and see the dynamics out of this and ask yourself the question of where do the errors come from and how do they impact everything? Okay, now let your mind drift back to the first class. We had this very simple experiment. We said, rotate the phase until all the neutrons come out of the O beam. Right? That was the first step. Rotate phase rotate phi, so that all neutrons are detected at O. And then we put a cadmium block there. And you argued that, hey, you couldn't come up with the classical distribution of this, right? That this very simple experiment demonstrated the uniquely quantum behavior of quantum superpositions, right? Perfect. Now take the same model, take the same piece, and apply it to this model. And tell me for what ranges of, for what settings of the transmission coefficient and for what amplitudes of the noise are you still unable to come up with a classical model? Okay, so your classical model is pretty simple. It says that you have some defined probabilities over those two paths. And you can see that, take this first step. Rotate phase so that all neutrons are detected at the O beam. Well, you can no longer do that, right? You can rotate it so you get a maximum, but it's not zero at the other one, right? And then, of course, you still have this noise in there to contend with, yeah? So take this piece and convince yourself that you can calculate correctly where, for this particular experiment, there becomes a separation between what is uniquely a quantum dynamic and those dynamics of a quantum system that could be modeled by a classical system, right? So I'm absolutely not telling you that for certain settings, the neutron interferometer becomes classical. No way. I can always do a post-selection experiment that's going to return the quantum nature of it. That's not the piece. But for certain settings, it's not uniquely quantum mechanical. And that is a really important piece to understand as we go and try to build quantum devices. Because we're only, of course, going to have to achieve quantum efficiencies with devices that are uniquely quantum mechanical. And if you understand it for this really simple system, you understand it for every quantum system, right? There's nothing more that you need to worry about for other qubits. We'll make other qubits very, very complicated because that's the way nature gives them. But the essence of understanding them is right here. Okay? Any questions? Yeah?
What's the point with cadmium block?
Cadmium absorbs all neutrons.
So isn't lead better?
I'm sorry.
Lead isn't better?
No, absolutely not. You know, remember if we're looking at neutrons, it's not the density that matters. It's not like gamma rays, right? But with gamma rays, what do we want? We want density because the electron density is directly proportional to the physical density, right? We want lots of electrons. But for neutron, what we actually want is a big capture cross-section. And so cadmium has a huge capture cross-section. Now, I could put... I could use instead germanium or boron or gadolinium, but germanium has the drag that it scatters. Gadolinium is great, but it's expensive. You know, boron, we need boron 10, not boron 11. So, cadmium is a good choice, and you know, with a small thickness, we can keep all of them out of there. Other questions? Okay, then we'll stop here. Tomorrow, I'm in Boston. So during this time, you'll have a tutorial. And then we'll figure out on Monday having two lectures.
Instead of the tutorial.
Okay. Yeah.
Here.
Good, thanks.